Good afternoon. Okay. So, what I'd like to do first off this afternoon is invite all panel members up to the table. And if you can, what I'd like to do this session is provide the board. We've heard both Phil and Hans's presentation on how they did all the work, great work that they did. And then we heard public comments about some of the work. And what I'd like to do is give the board one last opportunity to ask the panel questions themselves. And so if we could start off, and if the panel would introduce yourselves, and maybe you can talk about your expertise and your experience.
Hi, yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Maroney. I am the Director of Fisheries and Water Resources for the Kalispell Tribe. I've been with the tribe for 23 years, started out as a fish biologist. And mainly the thing that I kind of like about this exercise is I mainly deal in policy negotiations, and it was actually kind of a refreshing activity to actually engage just into the science component of it. So, but that's, prior to that, I worked for about 4 years in the Clearwater National Forest and Stream Surveys, dating back to the early 90s.
Thank you for having us here. My name is Ray Tim. I'm a senior scientist at Kramer Fish Sciences. I've been aquatic ecology ecosystems for 24 years. My role at the science panel is largely as a spatial scientist and disturbance ecologist.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Kai Ross. I'm a biometrician for Kramer Fish Sciences. In this project, I was mostly responsible for the data analysis and data collection on kind of QA/QC.
Brian Franson. I'm a consultant now. I was on the original water piping committee with Chair Burnett, co-chair of the Senior In-Stream Scientific Advisory Group for 7 years, and scientist studying a lot of things related to this issue over the past 30 years.
I'm one of the graybeards. I'm a retired fishery scientist. I spent 25 years in the Forest Service as a biologist and a national fish ecologist. Lately, I was the director of the USGS Science Center, and so I've had a lot of experience in fish habitat relationships and forest and systems things.
And your name?
Jeff Kirshner.
Thank you.
I knew there was some that I forgot.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, happy Tuesday. I'm Pete Disson. Half my career was with Weyerhaeuser, the other half was with the Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station, and I am currently a retired aquatic biologist.
And my name is Patrick Trotter. I'm a cold water fisheries ecologist. I'm actually coming out of retirement for this gig also, so but I had some acquaintance with Harvest. They used to call it the Timberfish Wildlife Program way back in the late 1990s. So after a long absence, well, I couldn't resist the invitation to join. Thanks.
I just want to mention Pat was part of the stream typing subcommittee of the Forest and Fish Report, and a lot of his thoughts of what we're doing today.
Thank you. We blame him.
Yeah, we can blame him. Yeah. So, board members, who would like to ask the first question? Board Member Davis.
Yeah, maybe just building on Board Member Swedeen's comment before lunch, there's that, what do we really have going on in front of us? What are these different alternatives? The fact that, you know, our responsibility as board members is protecting the, you know, the public trust part of this, the public resource part of this at the same time. Making sure that we're looking out for the economic viability of the industry at the same time. Given that we use the water type forms that had concurrence, I guess I'm just wondering how close are these alternatives to what we're putting on the ground already? In other words, you know, is it small incremental things that we might see across the landscape with the different alternatives? Are we driving the end of type F way upstream, or are we driving it downstream? And I think that's important as we take a look at the fish risk and compare that to what the potential economic effects might be. Is that clear?
That was clear. We're just looking at each other excited.
Sure.
Okay.
So more about, well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Chairman. Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, Joe and Brian, aren't you current practitioners or most recent practitioners? I'm trying to figure out who should start.
Well, I think that I'll initially respond to that. I mean, obviously, without testing all these on the ground, we don't know specifically, but my general impression is, since these are the starting point of a protocol, electric fishing circuit, that we're probably not talking about huge differences in the options in terms of where you might end up. Again, well, and when I say huge differences, my assumption is there may be a few hundred meters difference. Maybe less, a lot less. But without kind of testing them all, I it's kind of speculation. And I don't think we have the data in the, we didn't have the data to test that. So.
Anybody else from the panel?
I'm the guy from the one out of the nine reviewing my identity. It's a good question, and I think my concern and the reason I didn't support any specific recommendations is I don't feel that we have that information in hand. And in all my years of being before the board and dealing with this issue, there's two things that people want to know. What is the accuracy of these alternatives, and how is the error allocated? Is there a bias, systematic bias, upstream or downstream with whatever change is being contemplated? And I agree with Phil that the data that were the primary data for the report anyway aren't up to that task. I think there's other data that it could have taken more advantage of, but due to time constraints and other issues, we can fully analyze that. So my concern is that the use of the percent captured metric isn't really an indication of that. the accuracy, what you need to understand the deviation from current practice, which is an important remaining issue in my opinion.
Anybody else? Okay, let's go with the next board member, Gunther.
Well, thank you guys for all the work that you've done. I really appreciate it and appreciate the information we received this morning. But one of the questions that I have is that how many seasons do you folks feel it would take to validate your findings? Say if you pick three or four of the measures that you've identified, how many field seasons do you think it will take?
Can I just clarify? So if you're the validation study we've talked about, which frankly would apply to any of the alternatives, which is really collecting the data to evaluate any of the alternatives, whichever one you choose, and if there's anything else, what we've talked about is it would need it to be it would need to be multiple seasons. First of all, I should say it should need to be seasonally because there's some concern about the change in fish distribution throughout the year. And there's some concern about changes in fish distribution across years. So we've talked about something that's more on the order of 3 to 5 years because you'd want to get at least three to get the variance around the point, we need at least three, to resample it three times to see if that fish distribution has changed. We think that's what it takes to do the validation study. To validate one specific alternative, at least do an initial evaluation, probably could be done in a couple field seasons, but you wouldn't have that interannual variability. You might get some seasonal variability, you might be able to see if people end up in the same, you might see if you end up in the same place, but getting the interannual part is what is going to make that longer. Also, to do this properly, it need to be stratified across ecoregions. So you got 7 ecoregions, you need at least 50 sites per ecoregion. So you're suddenly talking about sampling, 350, 400 sites. And so it's not a small lift to do that. Though, if you talk to the folks who do a lot of water type modifications, they're doing 1,000 a year or something like that. So.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that is a good question. It's always dangerous to ask a scientist how long a study took too long. We'll always say way more than what the policymakers would like. And I mean that only partly facetiously. But in this case, your specific question about how long should the study last, particularly when it relates to fish distribution, is going to be very much weather dependent. The amount of movement you see in the uppermost fish in a drainage system in its various tributaries will be strongly influenced whether it's a wet or a dry year. And so it's nice to have the luxury of a couple of years to do the study, but if they happen to be very similar years, low water years, say, or high water years, you might come to a slightly different conclusion than you would if the weather conditions were the other way around. So in the end, I suspect that it might be to the board's advantage to leave some flexibility in the years in which the surveys are done so that you can capture a bit of a range in those weather conditions. Because as we all know here from Western Washington, weather's going to matter a lot, and Eastern Washington too.
So in my limited experience, I agree with you that a little more time sometimes will create a lot better accuracy. And that's, from my perspective, accuracy is what it's about.
Phil or whomever on the panel, can you guys speak to where we're at on the validation study, when you hope to send it to ISPR? Is there going to be a stakeholder opportunity to weigh in on the study design?
Yeah, but could I just make one comment on, and then Hans can give you more on the time frame.
So we've had, we've actually discussed the basic design, and we've got it more or less laid out. We're basically at the point where we need to write it up. We need to do some sample drawing, or drawing of samples across the state, just as an initial approach. So we're still in the, we've discussed it, we've got all the ideas down, or so we've got them, we need to flesh it out, and then it needs to go back around the group before it goes external. But I'll let Hans chime in on the rest of the time.
So as soon as the panel puts together a draft, it's going to go to the stakeholder technical group that we've been working with already, as well as the remaining members of ISAG that are not part of that. So that's a CEMER process. And then following that initial review, it's going to go to ISPR, and I've already spoken with the ISPR managing editor, Dan Vogt. And then it's going to go out for blind peer review. And then and I've talked to Dan about the timeline of about a month to get it back, and so it'll be available before the board's meeting in May. So that's what we're looking for. We're still on target for May.
Thank you. Board members, we don't.
Let's see. So I have a couple questions, and I'll start with the first one, and then maybe let ask one before I go on to my second one. But I, because we heard in public comment this morning concern about the alternatives that you guys put together that shook out from your data analysis. Let's put it that way. These things came out of your data analysis. You didn't you know, pick them a priori. That they may not reflect conditions or concerns in the lower elevation anadromous zone. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit, both from the perspective of why that might have been. For instance, is that just a reflection of the fact that most of the water type mod forms were further up the system and so didn't kind of reflect what was going on down there? So that question of why that may have been. And then the second question, just, I mean, you all represent an incredible amount of knowledge and experience, and we don't have access to your collective knowledge very often. So would you be willing, would any of you be willing, or all of you be willing to talk about what you think would be appropriate measures to capture, to make sure that this PHB system is actually appropriately capturing habitat in the anadromous zone. Two parts.
I have one comment on the anadromous zone and what happens down there. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been a whole lot of attention focused on that area. At one of the stakeholders meetings, one of the earlier ones, I was taken to task. I'm responsible for that 3-foot drop thing, so I'll try my best to explain what I came down here later. At that point, somebody who was concerned about what happens in the anadromous zone decided to raise that issue. And so one of the little things I've kind of done on the side is to do a kind of a quick and dirty literature survey to see just how anadromous zones are defined. They are defined in the state of Washington, even though it might be sort of casual. There's a gradient limit that beyond which adult anadromous fish don't seem to go. Sometimes the reason for that is if there is one of these barriers that's, you know, versus rocks that are much higher than 3 feet in the way, and so they can't. But even when that happens, tributary systems that might head up in higher elevations or steeper gradients. In fact, as I recall, my numbers are a little fuzzy here because I've been out of the picture for so long, I haven't really paid much attention. But in some of the earlier data sets we got in the beginnings of stream typing, I got a chance to look at the actual numbers of uppermost fish recorded that were identified by species. Coho salmon appear in those numbers, none of the other juvenile salmons did. But the places where they found were typically below that same gradient level. And there are some physiological reasons, there's some life cycle reasons why that might be the case when you start looking at that. Coho salmon juveniles, for example, have certain rather pronounced habitat requirements, and you don't find them in these high gradient reaches for one thing. So there's some reasons why this gradient level of say 7 to 10% is kind of the uppermost limit for anadromous fishes. What I didn't find was a whole lot of actual published peer-reviewed data that specified all of that in the literature. So a lot of that was a lot of the reasons for establishing those limits and using this kind of a common threshold for anadromy were based a lot of times on some pretty veteran field experiences. And everybody just sort of agreed that this will be the level that we choose. You can't really find a whole lot of anything else except maybe in their old field notebooks if anybody still keeps them to actually establish that definitively.
So one thing I just wanted
to... But I'm really interested in it.
Just wanted to add to that and maybe more directly answer your question. Is that I think in the lower elevation streams, I mean, most of these anadromous fish streams, as Pat was saying, is that, it's get to 10% and we don't see a lot of fish in, anadromous fish in there. And so when we have a threshold of 10%, most of the low gradient streams where anadromous fish are already below that. The other thing is when we get to if you hit a spot that's 10% in a low elevation stream, that's a starting point of a protocol survey, because that would be the threshold. And then if you go up there and you find fish, you move on to the next point. So I think in some sense it's the most of the criteria that we propose, at least for Western Washington, I think all of them are a threshold of 10%, maybe one's 5%. But they're 10 or 15%. That's going to, most of the anadromous fish streams and the lower elevation streams are going to be a lower gradient.
But a quick follow-up question. Again, this kind of gets back to my question about when you use, in those options, when you use a combination. So you've got like the 10 foot two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think I heard this morning concern, and I can't remember if you directly articulated it or it was Jim Peters, but that there are 2 foot wide streams below that 10% gradient that can be accessed by coho, and that they would get caught up in that PHB and maybe result in fishing where it wasn't necessary or important. And so if you use the combination of the two, and it's an either or and not a both, then you could have a PHB in a 2 foot wide stream in the anadromous zone where juvenile coho would be accessing those streams. Am I articulating that concern?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I may have misunderstood. I clarify me if I get this wrong. What happens in a situation like that, though, is that they do tend to respond to the same physical characteristics of the stream than the other salmon. And like I said, in the streams where they found them and identified them, in this earlier stream tracking method, I guess I just said it, they were identified as coho and recognized as such. And that turns out to, that shows up in a lot of the distribution of pie charts I've ever seen for what constitutes an uppermost fish.
The other thing is that it would be particularly valuable, I think, as several of us mentioned, for the validation study to include a variety of flows, all seasons, and that's because that some of the low gradient floodplain streams, which may fall below the 2% criterion, may be quite suitable temporary habitat for species like coho in the wintertime, and that's been pretty well documented scientifically. So by expanding the surveys to a variety of flow conditions, then we'll be able to determine whether or not the suite of criteria we've applied now are applicable during the wintertime as well as during the current survey window, which is what, in March to mid-July. At that point, streams are dropping and they tend to be shrinking anyway, but it is important during the wintertime. And that's why it'll be important to include that.
One thing maybe to consider is that I think the current default physicals are 2 feet. So you don't have to look. It's not considered fish habitat. So what we're proposing is if you've got the 2 foot wide stream, you have to look to see if there's fish. It would lead to more electrofishing, but it would also lead to checking those small streams to see if they're actually usable.
Following up on that, it may be some speculation, but that's kind of what we're getting here a little bit. And wondering if you could look at some of these different alternatives that we've been given, some of the alternatives, and give us some idea of how much electrofishing you see would happen in these different alternatives. Do you have can you tell us that there'd be a lot more in one and a lot less in another?
That's a fair question. It's not one I don't think I can answer that, because I don't think we know how, without testing these on the ground. Also, it's you know, as soon as you hit or turn a fish, you're going to stop electrofishing. So I think since there's 9 of us here, I'll start from what I think, and then maybe someone else can give you their opinion. But I don't think there's going to be a huge, I think we're not talking hundreds and hundreds of meters. And I'm sorry if I use meters instead of feet. I'm used to using meters and not feet and stuff. There may be some differences in how much you'd electrofish among these. I don't think it's going to be huge, but we really don't know without testing.
Okay, so following up on that then, is there a reason why, in your opinions, collective opinions, why we wouldn't just adopt the WDFW protocol for identifying the break? We talked about this earlier, it came up, and I just wonder if you all have some thoughts on that and why we're doing this, why we couldn't just use another agency.
Maybe WFW.
So I think it's important to note that our barrier criteria is developed specifically around, for the most part, culverts or road crossings. And so it's a different environment that some of it might apply, but not everywhere that we're looking at.
Let me just reinforce that one too. I agree that it's a different environment for those particular protocols. But I did do a sort of a literature search on what constitutes barriers, which turns out to be the same one we came up with. So, you know, we're in agreement there. We all seem to agree on what's a physical barrier in moving fish, and then jumping into culverts and road crossings and things like that is a set of sort of off the one side from what we've been talking about, that set of that sort of thing.
Board Member Herrera.
I wanted to follow up a little bit on this, anadromous zone kind of concept, and I bring it up because back in our August board meeting I had, when we looked at the report you all had produced, and we actually put several motions out. The motion that I put out was, I think it was your option number 9, but I had also included, I think, building off the 10% there. That, part of that was to include this 10% gradient point. So anything downstream of that would be would not be subject to protocol surveys, but would be assumed to be the anadromous zone. And then I think going upstream from there, trying to recall, I looked at this lately, but maybe to the next PHB and start implementing the protocol surveys. So yeah, there's context. I wanted to ask, when you looked at the data, you know, you had looked at the landowner data that had been supplied initially, and then you went back and brought in additional data. You looked at landowner, and according to your report and what I've heard, I think you guys report this morning was you didn't have time to look at the Puget lowland or coastal ecoregions. So, but then you went and essentially looked at the landowner data, I think, along with some of the new data, and essentially expanded it, I guess, for that. Expanded that out to cover those areas. And I just wanted to ask about that because it seems like, from what I understand about, even from testimony this morning, a lot of that, or if not most or all of that, landowner data looked at pretty high gradient, small streams. So I wonder how that translates to lowland Puget Sound, where it's a flat gradient and they tend to be larger streams. So I was just curious how, you must have been confident that that was a good reflection of what was happening in the lowland. Is that, would you say that?
Well, I think it seems like there's a couple points to make and then a response to question. So yeah, I think that what we've run a number of different, we've got the scenarios that are in here, and there's been some minor ones, that minor tweaks to like number 9 to create a floor, so everything less than that. And you know, every time we've gotten a minor change than one of these, we've rerun this to see, because we're like, well, we overlooked something, you know. And so we rerun. There was what we've seen is that those criteria where you have everything below 10% is automatically, you know, anadromous fish habitat or fish habitat, are not performing as well as some of the other one in capturing the points. Now, it is possible that our sample is, I should say that our sample of the landowner data set, so we didn't have data from our random sample, we didn't have time to do the Puget Lowlands for the coast. So we took a random sample of 70 points from the landowner data set for the Puget Sound lowlands, and 70% for coast range, or 70 points for the coast. So that's where those points came from, just to be clear on what the sample was. I personally can't, I think maybe the person to ask about the data would be Kai, if he knows how many of the landowner points from those two ecoregions, and whether they, what the makeup of those were, if we have much information about their elevation.
We have very little information about that. We didn't look at the distributions for those points based off of their elevation, or whether they were lowlands or uplands. We just took a random sample of the points and used them.
Part of that was because of the number of points in those two regions, and as well as stratifying by elevation, we started getting into what is low elevation and that type of thing.
So my recollection from the report you produced for our August meeting was that there were no data points for the Puget Lowlands or Fuller Lake included, as well as Eastern Washington.
There were points for the coast, and there were points for the Puget Sound low and ecoregion. I think it's maybe what we're talking, we may have looked at the elevation of those points and concluded there weren't very many that were at low elevation. We'd have to go back and look at those. I think that's what happened, is you're correct, and that most of those were over like a thousand. I don't want to throw out a number, but they were over a certain elevation. And so that could be a potential issue with the data for that ecoregion and the low elevation anatomy streams.
Board member Nelson?
Yeah, I never pass up a chance to ask a free question from lawyers or scientists. So we've got nine of you up here. I read the whole report, and I tried to follow it the best I could, and I think I did. And I got to page 40, where you talk about additional considerations. I would like to know from the nine of you, what you think about the additional considerations. Essentially, it's going to end the fish using the full study in 2006 and going up 100 meters above that and setting the FN break there. Now, I would, if I were going to propose something like that, I would tweak it a little bit, but I think that is a legitimate question for you guys. We went through all these different tests and all the permutations and combinations there are with the minor changes, and then you come up with this other idea, which is not included in any of the analysis. So, first of all, which one of you thought up this other consideration, and which of you like it, and which of you don't like it? I'll have an easier question later.
That's an idea that has been kicked around for quite some time, as various groups like this have struggled to find the answers. When we initiated the coal study and the Eastern Washington Variability Study, our goal was to figure out how to bridge the gap between fish use and fish habitat. So we collected all those data, and we found that the variability in where fish are over time occurs within a predictable range of distances, and we have good data on that. So that you could say, okay, if you want to get 50% of the variability, the answer is X feet, and you could have that for where fish are, and you'd have some known amount of the variability that you capture. It's very simple, and you can quantify it, and it's got some attributes that you guys may find attractive. On the other hand, the FHAM, the whole goal of the FHAM was to try and find site-specific cues on individual streams that would help you get that point exactly right. So the application of a fixed distance is kind of a broad brush solution across the landscape. It would work on average to the level that you wanted to encompass, but on any given stream, it may not make sense. You wouldn't want to go 100 feet past fish if there's a big waterfall 10 feet beyond fish, right? So it's the specificity of the water typing to what you see on the stream that was believed to be desirable in the FHAM. Lacking agreement on what those PHB criteria are, you could apply a fixed distance, but recognize the shortcomings of that as well. It's not going to be as accurate, likely, than a more site-specific solution based on what you see on the ground when you're out there. This, again, is supposed to be guidance for a surveyor to make good decisions, right, on a stream. And that's the FHAM. A fixed distance takes that away from the surveyor and puts the decision in you guys' lap, and would limit the ability of the surveyor to use what he or she sees on the ground in making a good decision.
But if I said I had some tweaks in mind, if you were to take this fixed distance above end of fish and you were to say go up for the 300 feet or to where an ID team agrees by consensus that the end of the habitat should be, or there's an existing crossing that's there because, and it's already covered in someone's RMAP completed plan. If you put those kind of quantifiable things in there, whatever you get first, the obstacle, the pipe, whatever, then you would get rid of some of that bias that you just talked about, wouldn't you?
Yes, it's an alternative that hasn't had much work on it. It could be evaluated as an alternative, but it hasn't been the task of this group at this point to do that. So we haven't done anything.
So, and this is one thing that at least Brian and I have talked about, you know, probably at least over the last year. So, you know, he may say 300 feet, I may say 300 meters plus or minus, you know, a lot more. So, and one of the things is, you know, you brought up, you know, man-made culverts. You know, in my opinion, those are, you don't take those into account when you're going through this process. Is because you're looking at as if you're moving up the stream. If you encounter a culvert, I just imagine it's not even there, and you keep on going above that.
Even if there's no fish.
Well, probably the reason why there's no fish is probably because of the culvert.
Well, that, I mean, an ID team will be able to figure that out. Anyway, I don't want to talk about the tank.
You already took us there. All right, other board member questions? If not, I've got several.
Yes, if no one was going to ask, I was going to jump in.
Okay. All right, so going back to one of the previous questions about how often would, say, a 10% gradient absolute versus a change in 5% gradient, seems like most of these streams where you're talking about the upper limits of fish presence and their higher gradient areas. So wouldn't it, so help me why you couldn't answer that question about how often would you see the change, meaning how often would you have to stop and do some kind of protocol and then move on as for one versus the other.
So why couldn't we answer your question originally? Because
right.
why can't I answer it? Answer
well, I mean, just for a practical standpoint.
It's a straightforward question. And I think that one of the challenges that we have is that we need data along a bunch of representative streams to do that. So we actually tried to look and see if we could find, you take this off a stream layer with LIDAR and find all the inflection points so that we could actually say, hey, what would this actually, what's the difference between using a threshold and a change and a ratio?
Mm-hmm.
And we found pretty quickly that we couldn't, the stream layer doesn't match up with the LIDAR, and so we found pretty quickly that we couldn't do that with what we had. So that's the reason we can't answer that, is that we don't have, even with the, you know, it doesn't matter which of the couple data sets we have, we don't have information on all the inflections in the stream, and which is, you know, I hate to be the scientist that's always saying, oh, we need to do a study, and you know, this is why we're going to do a study, and this is why you need to give us money to do a study. But in this particular case, we really don't have, you know, we don't have information on that. To run out and do that in a handful of streams, no, it wouldn't take very long to do it in a handful of streams. You'd probably need to do it in a lot of places across the state, and then we're suddenly turned into
study. Okay. Another question, we heard several public comments suggesting the coal study should have been used for the east side recommendations. Did you guys look at that? Or can you respond to that? I know it came up a number of times in our discussions, why don't we use the coal study data? And I remember we looked at it, and I, off the top of my head, I don't remember why we didn't use that. I'm hoping one of the other panel members can answer that question with more.
This is your big chance to speak up.
I think we probably should have. That was one of my concerns. I recommended that we incorporate that into the analysis, especially since Eastern Washington didn't have a lot of good quality data. So I think it's something that still could be done. My conclusion is that given the quality of the data sets we have available, that looking at multiple data sets, each have their strengths and weaknesses, might be a good way to look at this stuff. The original landowner data was not dispersed uniformly across Western Washington, but it had complete measurements for fish and habitat for all of the PHP categories, so it's the strength of that. Same with the coal study data on the east side. And the new stuff is more dispersed, there's good things about that too, but in combination, I think the data would be more powerful if we looked across all the available data. And certainly the Eastern Washington CEMER data, we spent $500,000 collecting that information. So it seems like the opportunity, yes, that we didn't do that.
I've got another question for Kai.
Okay, sorry.
So, Kai, since you're the biometrician, there were several comments during the public comment period about the amount of data in the landowner data set versus the representative data that you guys. So can you talk about what you were trying to do and the power of statistics and that just because one data set has like 1,500 points versus 700 points, can you talk about what's important as far as the power of statistics and getting representative samples?
Yeah, so, you know, the big issue here is wanting to get enough samples to be able to adequately describe the distribution. And so 30 points is a lot, 700 is more, 1,000 is even greater than that. But at some point, you think we've got a good enough representative sample to kind of draw one of those histograms and maybe either smooth it or make a kernel density plot to give us kind of a representation that we think we've sampled enough points that we've kind of captured the variance. And that's the big point in one of these sample size estimates, is to be able to sample enough that we get the mean effect as well as kind of the variance to kind of get what the distribution looks like. Based off of some of the original data that we have from the landowner data set is what we use to calculate our power sample size calculations. And that's where that's where that 50 to 70 came from, was based off of the number of samples we thought we'd need to calculate the kind of encapsulate the variance of those distributions.
Can I just comment on the coal study real quickly? One of the issues we had with using some of that data was the way that gradient was measured differently in that than some of the other data sets. So I know I know Brian feels strongly that we should have used that data set, but I remember we looked at this and there was one of the reasons had to do with some of the gradient measurements, but I thought there might have been some other ones I don't recall at the moment. We that was a discussion back in last summer sometime.
So one other question for me, I noticed that you were using wetted width and generally
Chairman Burnett, can I ask a follow-up,
sure,
though, to your statistical,
sure,
your data statistics before you go to a different topic?
Sure.
So I'm a little bit confused about some of you may have heard my earlier questions about how do you get yourself comfortable with using, you know, the 700 data points to extrapolate and represent the whole state. Well, I don't completely understand what bias there's perceived to be in the landowner data, except that it had something to do with starting measuring from the beginning of the main stream all the way up the tributaries, and so there's some ratios that are off. That's layman's understanding. So anyway, a lot of the data was excluded. So why or how do you scientifically justify going back to the polluted pool of data and pulling samples to represent the coast and the Puget lowlands? Because you just told me that that data set wasn't valid. And now do I have... So I just, I'm really trying to get my head wrapped around what we use for data to make a statewide rule.
Let me take that initial crack and chime in. I mean, first of all, there's a couple different issues here. One was what we were, the board instructed us to do, which was to draw a random sample. And there was another motion that had to do with supplementing that with some of the landowner data. The reason that I think in our first cut at this, our draft final report, we didn't have samples from the Puget Lowland or the Coast Ecoregion. When we were doing our revision, we discussed it and said, well, wait a minute. We looked at the distribution of the new, this random sample, and we looked at the distribution of landowner data. These are both for Western Washington. They look very similar. So we said, well, look, you know, part of our instruction was to supplement this. So we thought it was reasonable to take a random sample of the landowner data for those two ecoregions that we didn't have data. And so yes, that data set, there was a lot of concerns raised with it, and it wasn't exactly clear how some of the information that was came about, the information that was in there. When we started looking at the distributions, we said, well, it looks pretty. I mean, the distributions for Western Washington from the random sample and the landowner data set, which was non-random, they looked pretty similar. So we thought it was okay. We felt comfortable and we thought we should take a random sample for those two ecoregions. It's 140 points total, so that we rounded out what we had for Western Washington. Also, that was one of the comments we got on our draft from the stakeholders, is why didn't you take a random sample from these other two ecoregions that we didn't have data for? And the reason we didn't have data was the timeline. And just to get I'll save that. I have another point, but I'll wait till the question comes up.
Okay. I think that.
Well, that's good.
Well, you're the data guy. QAQC. Explain to me how it passed your QAQC threshold. I don't want to use that word threshold.
Barrier.
Process. Your QA process.
Mention again that it's not that necessarily the landowner data was somehow polluted and
I know that was
usable.
A bad
it
word
was,
too.
It was
I'm
more
full of bad words.
The issue was the spatial kind of clustering, and we wanted to make sure we had a representative sample spatially across. So that was one of the main reasons that we wanted to resample across these water type odd forms. It wasn't necessarily because we thought that the data was bad, it just wasn't necessarily representative of multiple locations across the state.
Can I add to that? Mm-hmm. So all of the data were landowner data. All of the water type odd forms we looked at were landowner data. What we didn't know when we started this second round of analysis was that they weren't all like the first data set that we had obtained from the Weyerhaeuser data sets. We thought everybody entered their water type mod forms and they would be as clean and as usable as those data sets, and that turned out not to be the case, which is why we had one for the Blue Mountains and we ended up not having a significant sample for many of our other ecoregions. That's why we ended up pooling east side and west side. But all the data were landowner data. So it's not like there was some bad thing about the landowner data.
Yeah, I guess I meant landowner data in that the work that had been done previously had already been accumulated database, and I thought part of your QA, QC process was going to be validating what's already, what was there. So it was kind of like you guys started over, but reached in and grabbed a few, well, 140, 20% of your points came from compiled data from the first study. So.
But remember, on the analysis, we use the landowner data to sort of match up and see.
That's that other column, the second to last column to show me what the.
We included that landowner data to make sure we were, just to see whether there were really distinct differences between the two data sets.
Okay.
So there's a couple small comments this morning, and I think one was from you, board member Nelson, and another one was from a member of the public, and it had to do with I think some concern about and there are two aspects of the concern. One concern was data not being coincident with where the last fish was, and then there's also been you know, the public has reminded the board on several occasions that we have to balance, our rule has to balance the risks. The error needs to be small, but there needs to be some sort of balance of risk on the resource protection side and on the economic hit side. And I was asking some questions of some of the, you know, technical stakeholder people, and they said that they had looked at the, you know, the database of points that DNR made public on their website, and it looked like, you know, something over 60% of the points that actually did get used were coincident with those of last fish. And so if that's the case, it would seem like, I mean, so maybe that didn't come out in the report, but it seemed like that might address your concern that a large proportion of the data didn't, gives you information about or represents conditions that were found in the field. It wasn't habitat beyond, the break was put where nose of last fish, and it wasn't habitat beyond. And so that kind of goes into the second part of my question, is it seems like if that's the case, and there's also been identifications of situations where the current system is more dependent on fish presence instead of fish habitat, that the change we're looking at would go somewhat in the direction of trying to balance that risk out a little bit more. So it seems, I think what I'm trying to get at, and then you guys correct me if I'm wrong, what I'm trying to get at is given what you found in the water type mod forms and the fact that a bunch of these alternatives are based on, you know, about two-thirds of the point that's actually nose of last fish, that we're still essentially going to have a system that's based a little bit more on fish presence than it is on fish habitat. But we're, because of the way that FHAN framework looks at, we're going to fix that a little bit by, you know, requiring a sort of a change in the distribution of electrofishing surveys. So I'm looking for some comment on like how, as the board thinks about, you know, any of these alternatives, how do we think, based on the data and based on the outcome of the analyses, how do we think about addressing that shared risk? And in my mind, based on that pattern and based on past practice, we're still sort of in the territory of having several potential situations in which we're basing our system way more on fish presence than we are on fish habitat. So can you comment on that?
Can I clarify that? Because my comment wasn't about using fish presence nose of last fish. I don't think anyone has used nose of last fish for many, many years in practice. That may be what the existing rules say, but in practice, everyone has been finding the last fish and then moving upstream and with an ID team setting the habitat where they thought it should be. So I don't think it's fair to say that 60% of the points are nose of last fish. I doubt that there's any. My comment was,
from the one set of data, the original landowner data, it was screened out so that there were measurements of end-of-life fish up to where the potential habitat break would indicate and the fish habitat. In the second set of data, I do not think that was the case. I think a lot of those water type mods went to end of fish habitat without knowing where end of fish was. That's what I was trying to say.
So, but I think my point was that someone actually went, someone on the technical stakeholder looked at the data, and what you just said didn't turn out to be true. And these guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that it's true that two-thirds of the points, or about two-thirds of the points that went into their analysis was actually nose of last fish and not end of habitat.
I don't think that's the case, but you got nine guys up there.
Yeah.
Or tell us.
Okay, so oftentimes fish are coincident with the end of habitat, and if a concurrent survey has end of habitat at the same location as the end of fish, there's a big change there. There's a gradient break of some meaning. There's a barrier. There's a change associated with it, or it wouldn't make it through the concurrence process. So just because they're coincident doesn't mean that it's wrong or below the end of habitat. It's there's a feature associated with that. So what we're kind of missing, though, are places where fish use ended, where a surveyor kept going. That's what's lacking in data, which is an important part of the equation if you're going to understand accuracy and error. If a surveyor sees where a fish ends and keeps going, then whatever was going on there was not a big enough change in his opinion to stop. Whereas a surveyor stops at the end of fish, there must be something big there to justify the end of habitat. And the interplay between those two decisions is how you get to accuracy and error and understanding.
Let me just clarify a little bit more. The one of the big differences, well, first of all, it wasn't that 60% of the points were concurrent with end of fish. In fact, in the new, the random sample, the new, I forget what we were calling it, the expanded data set, most of those water type mod forms, they didn't report where the end of fish was. They went to end of fish and then they went upstream and there was a concurred point. So we had data on the concurred point. What Brian is talking about is if you have the end of fish, you can see if the surveyor for the points that weren't concurrent with the end of fish, you can see if the surveyor continued or not, and you can see if the criteria we would use you can look at the survey. I mean, it gets more at the surveyors and the concurrence process and whether those the agreement with those. So it's more of a valid. I guess I'm not in agreement with Brian that that's a way to look at the error. I think that what we're looking at is how well did the surveyor do. And I don't think that's the question. In my view, we've been trying to focus on what the PHB is, and yeah, it's nice to know whether the surveyor in this particular case continued or not, but that's a little bit different question. So I don't necessarily agree it's the error, but I want to make it clear that we did not have end of fish on 60% of the points. In fact, I think in the random sample, it was more like I don't know. There was I think it's less than 100 points that they where the forms reported against.
That was the point.
Yeah.
But
we don't know.
That's right. That's my question.
We did know.
Okay. Sorry, just clarification.
Okay. Did it change your answer?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Okay.
Because we're not confused enough, so roll it through.
We see the data.
Well,
okay.
It really has to do with there's a difference between having an end of fish point that is a fish plus, right? So you'd have the end of fish point, then there'd be some plus. Then that would be up to the break.
Right.
And so we didn't have that level of information, but when the end of fish was coincident with the end of habitat, mm-hmm. that was the data set that we had. So we only had the ones that were coincident. We didn't necessarily have the ones that weren't.
Okay.
It's not a huge issue. Again, we don't have a way to say that they were wrong or right, but we didn't have, so we had those places where it was coincident.
Yeah, what I meant to say is that there was about 100 points that we had that they went beyond end of fish, and they gave us both the measurements of the concurrent upon break and the end of fish in the random sample. In the landowner data set, there were a lot more of that information available because that's something they report.
So, if we're laughing
and
agreement on the fees, would using the default physical criteria as an interim approach, would that be reasonable? It looked like it tested well, and it was test number 3. So I just wonder if the default physical criteria, which are already in the rule, if that would be a reasonable approach. Sorry, page 32.
I think the difference with the defaults is they're it's and. So it's a gradient and a banked fold or a channel. And what we tested was or. It's either one or the other. If you reach one of them, then it's a PHP.
Excuse me, you just said that the cold data was in fact in eastern Washington, but it didn't do well with the data.
I'm sorry, the false physical default.
Page 34.
The default physicals require both to be true. And I've done quite a bit of analysis in that. And that against the landowner data, percent captured was 9%, if you like that metric. And if you like agreement with what a surveyor said in concurrent with the survey, it's only about 30%. So in my experience with the Western Washington defaults, they're the worst performing in any alternative I've evaluated. And they're biased in one direction. It's almost always overestimating where a concurrent with survey would have called the break.
Any further, I want to make sure that board members have a clear idea of the different definitions that have been used around the table, because tomorrow we're probably going to be presented with a couple of alternatives on that we should consider moving forward. And I want to, since we got the experts here, if you have any further questions about definitions, like to get those taken care of today.
Were you going to ask the question about the wetted width versus the?
Oh yeah.
That's when I interrupted you. So.
Yeah, that's okay. I was going to let go of that one.
No.
Okay.
I'm not sure at the moment. I'm kind of at a loss as to the wetted width thing too, because. In my thinking anyway, and I thought that what we all were on the panel kind of locked in on is thankful with. And when people would say just kind of pop off the turf little channel widths, stream width or whatever, that's for the purposes of what we were trying to do, it was supposed to be wet or thankful width.
Right, and that's basically been a lot of
anyway, land. it seemed like there was a lot of fuzziness in that term. So, kind of somehow fix or the focus on thankful width, and that's what we're going to deal with. Otherwise, define something else clearly, because there was some misunderstanding like that. The other one that maybe I'm just kind of overly sensitive to was the term ferry. I, for one, came into the panel process thinking that barriers is just something that could impede, not necessarily totally block, the movement of fish upstream, as it moves. It already went down to upstream. It turned out that in my first experience on the panel with other people that weren't on the panel in the room, one of them bought a barrier as an absolute block. That kind of surprised me. But I think that's one of the big advocates of changing that term in our report to obstacles. But if we're going to use all of those terms, we need to maybe in the preface of, or in one of the appendices of one report or another, start defining them. Saying, when we say barrier, this is what we mean. When we say obstacle, this is what we mean. And the two aren't the same.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Pat brings up, I think, a really good point, because even today during testimony, people asking questions, you hear, stream width, channel width, flooded width. There's probably three or four other types of widths that you can probably throw out there. But I think bankful is the consistent one.
Any other questions from the board members? Board Member Nelson?
I have one more question. It's probably for Phil. Do you have any kind of a ballpark estimate what it would take you guys to go back and get some more usable data from South Puget and the east side that you could plug into this after the third report?
Did you know
what?
Yeah. So I think $1 million would probably. Well, we got the trash and the portion of that.
So I wasn't asking how much money, how much time.
I'm going to be frank that I won't speak for all the panel members, but I know most of us feel like that. Bit of a fool's errand to keep chasing after more data, and we really are not that. I'm personally not that. We're not that interested in doing that, because we don't think it's just going to lead to some more of this, frankly, which is interesting, but I don't know if it's getting you any closer to where you want to be. And personally, I don't want to waste your money on it.
And like turn over more rocks.
Yeah. And I don't want to be told, oh, well, that's great, but can you bring this, we want a different rock.
You get that all the time.
Any other questions from board members? Well, I just want to thank the panel for spending your time with us today, explaining what you did, how you did it. Caveats around all the data, and just really appreciate the work done for us.
And I guess one thing I'd just like to say, I guess the exciting thing is this was a data-driven process, which a lot of endeavors that I've done over the last couple of decades, I've kind of divorced myself from that because I just deal with policy stuff. So it was kind of exciting, being able to sit down with, this group here to just kind of roll up the sleeves and kind of look at the data and what is the data telling us. And, feeling pretty confident in what we came up with.
Just one last thing. We are very excited about completing the study design for you.
Yes, we are.
I just want to make sure that we have asked all the questions about the common definitions, because as I heard you say, Mr. Chair, we're gonna have different alternatives and variations probably of those alternatives coming at us tomorrow, and folks that have worked on maybe some of the variations of alternatives, we're gonna need to be talking about the same words the same way. And so I I just want to make sure that we do have all the potential definitions, or if the, some of the science panel members will be around tomorrow, that if we find ourselves in a, well, are you using it this way or that way, that we're not talking past each other and walking away with different understanding of what we may or may not agree to tomorrow.
I just want to ask a follow-up or maybe clarify a little bit. I mean, I think it's, we spent a lot of hours today on this topic and it's been extremely helpful, but we might be better at asking the right questions or understanding the context of those definitions when we're actually working through the alternatives. So, So that's, I mean, I kind of agree with you that if we had access to someone tomorrow, if Hans, I mean, you participated in this, and so, I mean, if you have the definitions well in your head, I mean, you can do that, and so we don't have to ask these guys to, you know, just stick around for a second day, that might be really helpful, but I'm
they
also...
want to stick around.
But I'm also saying that just for me personally, like, if you went through a bunch of definitions right now, my brain is probably a little bit mushy and wouldn't take it in as well as if you did it tomorrow in the context of, okay, we're narrowing down on just a few options, and what do these mean, and how do they lay out on the ground, and what are the implications? So that's probably more of a tomorrow discussion than it is a today discussion.
I was just going to say, what probably would be useful is if, we could go through the definitions, somebody can describe them to you, but we probably should put them down on a sheet of paper that everybody on the board has so that you can refer to them.
Yeah, we'll teach
you. Because there's so many acronyms. We tried to put a list of glossary or a list of acronyms in the front of the report, but I mean, there's end of fish, EOF, there's water type modification forms, water type modification form points, I think we can, just an easy, one page that has the definitions might help you.
And it's the definitions of the features in the table, right? Not like general terminology, but the things that were that are described as options. Like what is it? And I don't know. It's not taking too much time, but the features.
I'm not sure you want one. I won't be the one.
So, Hans, is that something that can we get a one pager tomorrow of say obstacles, barriers, the ratio, the threshold, the limit. So I'm just wondering, so that when we're looking at competing proposals tomorrow, we're using the same definitions. Also, I would, if anybody wants to draw cartoons up on the flip charts for tomorrow, that'd be fine. But I think that's one reason we put them in the room. We need to do that to illustrate what we're trying to get to.
So just to be clear, those are the five that you're interested in. Are there any others? Anything at the table? Is that what we're after? Okay. Thank you.
Just to clarify, you don't want Phil drawing on the table. Okay. More the panel members than he actually clarified. That sounds so bad.
I just confused Jeff. Don't let him. It was my handwriting.
So when you have a couple of different ways of describing gradient in your table, you have a couple of different ways of describing width in your table. And then we have barriers and obstacles. So I think those are the, are there any other definitions you guys?
Can end with us.
I was going to do like
something about
where I am especially.
Yeah, I know, but just having it clear.
Good.
And
okay.
Mr. Chair, I got one quick question. So tomorrow, the board is going to be taking a look at the options, the four options for Western Washington, the two options for Eastern Washington, plus also other options that are being floated, or?
Yeah, there's been
confused.
A couple of the boards received two proposals, one from the West Side Tribes and one from the Landowner Caucus. And so we want to make sure that when we're talking about the different metrics, we're all consistently talking about the same metrics. And if you don't have copies of those, you can get those to me.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, panel members.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. Thank you. All right, as much as I want to take a break, I'm going to ask, we have one more presentation and then we'll take a break. Mark, would you come up to the table? I want to do this while this is all fresh in our mind, because it became clear to me, not just in the public testimony today, but in the last few weeks, and people being concerned about what we're going to be doing tomorrow. So one of the things we're not going to be doing tomorrow is adopting a CR-102. And so that means we're not actually going to do any rule adoption tomorrow. We are going to be hopefully making some decisions on how to move towards adoption of a CR-102 later in the year. And so I've asked Mark to explain the rule adoption process from here on out, and we can have a little bit of a conversation about, you know, depending on what decisions you make tomorrow, how those carry on through the full rulemaking process. Because I know some of you are newish to the board and haven't been through complete rule adoption process yet. Some of you are old hands. And so we want to make sure that everybody's on the same page here. Are you doing snorkeling now?
It looks like it's
really nice. Great vacations.
This is setting the mood.
Also, I want to, so board members, if I get up and down, it's because I'm uncomfortable. So it's not because I'm trying to make a point or anything. It could be coincidental. But yeah. Okay, are you ready? So, as I mentioned, he's going to discuss next steps, and so take it away.
So good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Mark Engel, Assistant Division Manager of Forest Practices, Posting Services. It's my staff, which will be preparing all of the entire packet for the board to review and make a decision regarding when we initiate formal rulemaking, which is the filing of the CR-102. A lot of my presentation has been covered today in testimony, so for time I will go as fast as you allow me. However, I will stop at any point and answer questions. Oops. Boy, that is sensitive. So as you've heard today, I will say that this presentation is in your packet, so if you want to take notes, or I believe it's in the packet, right? Yes. So if you want to take notes, we did it where there's the slide and there's room for you to write down notes. Also, in anticipation for today, staff was very aware that we'd already received two proposals yesterday. So staff is going to make some recommendations in this presentation for the board to consider tomorrow. So the next steps in rulemaking, there are multiple statutes and rules that we need to follow as we prepare the packet. It's not just draft rule language. There's a number of other accompanying analysis that the board will have at that point. And again, as you've heard common theme today, that it's within the Administrative Procedure Act, which we'll just label APA as the presentation goes. There is an element that's in the Regulatory Fairness Act, and then of course there's SEPA, as well as Forest Practices Long-Term Maps, and I will explain the significance of that as I go through. But it is a significant analysis that staff needs to do in preparation of the packet. So, per the board direction of the November meeting, staff has completed the following. So the board does have, we have filed a CR 101 with the Office of Code Advisor, and basically this is a notification to the public that the board is considering rulemaking. So the 101 has been filed, and now we're putting together the information in order for the board to consider a 102. So at the November meeting, the board identified August as the adoption of the new water typing system rule. For staff to prepare the rule, we need to approve the criteria for the PHB. Now, in your packet today is part of the staff reports for both the rulemaking as well as the board manual. We've listed all of the elements that the board has already approved to be included in both the rule and in guidance. And we've listed the documents that contain that information. This was the bulk of the work that the board did at last May's meeting, when the board reviewed the recommendations brought forward by policy. So we have, for example, FHAM, the Fish Habitat Assessment Methodology, that was approved by the board last May, but an essential element in order to conduct a protocol survey are the potential habitat breaks. That is the last element that we need for us to really begin to complete all of the both the draft rule as well as the assessment to the products for the board to make a decision regarding a CR 102. So staff recommends that the board consider, and because there's a lot of options that have already been alluded to or talked about today, you know, the recommendation from the expert panel are four potential PHBs, west side, two east side, plus we have two that have come forward tomorrow. Because of that, we will need time to complete the analysis. And there's been a lot of talk today about what needs to be addressed in the cost-benefit analysis, for example. It is okay for the board to choose more than one alternative for staff to perform analysis of, and then give the board information. So you have a complete packet with rule language as well as potential PHBs and analysis associated with those PHBs. Because of that, board is recommending that the board consider holding a special meeting on the 27th of June, fully dedicated to just the 102, the decision by the board to initiate formal rulemaking. This is a little extra time after the May meeting, approximately 6 weeks, for staff then to complete all of the products that we need to review in order to make a decision. With that, staff is also recommending changing the meeting for the board to review the final product and consider rule adoption, which results in the filing of a CR 103 until the November meeting. With that, there will still be time for the rule to be formal, can't think of the word right now, and in place prior to next season's protocol season. And I'll pause there. I think the chair has comment.
No.
Go ahead. So the preparation of the draft rule and associated analysis for the board to review before considering involves the following steps. And I'm going to go pretty quick here because it has really been covered well today. Developing draft rule language that includes all the board approved elements, you know, pending action for the criteria tomorrow. That's our final element. In this preparation process, we need to solicit input on the draft language via stakeholder meetings. Mark Ratcliffe has already contacted all of the policy leads. We have names of folks who would like to participate. We're in the process of scheduling meetings in anticipation of board decision tomorrow. Then we have to analyze each of the board-approved elements, and by that, the analyses are SEPA, cost-benefit analysis, and small business economic analysis as well. And the SBEIS is part of the Regulatory Fairness Act. With that, I took some notes because I don't think it's appropriate today to go through virtually how we're going to conduct each analysis. I mean, we don't even have the PhDs yet, but I have some notes that we will definitely look at the social welfare issues, as well as, you know, the do no harm doctrine. Of course, we will analyze the current rule because that's the no change option. So, and I also, the cost benefit analysis determine the probable benefits of the rule are greater than is possible, this probable cost. So that is an element of a theme that's been addressed all day today.
Quick question, Mr. Engel. SEPA analysis, is that likely to be a checklist or EIS?
We're going to approach it as a checklist, but we prepare the SEPA checklist. It will go to the responsible official, which is the chair of the board, who, I'm ahead of myself. Let's get to the slide. There it is. It goes to the responsible official who does the kind of the preliminary determination of, you know, whether it's of non-significance or a mitigated determination of significance or determination of significance. That will be done through the normal CEPA process, and then and based on the analysis and the determination will dictate what the next steps are.
So you haven't decided ahead of time. I mean, that happens sometimes where people are, you know, we already know this is going to be an EIS, and but you're going to take it stepwise and make a decision based on starting from the checklist.
That's correct.
Okay.
Member Nelson.
A quick question. Mark, you just said that you're going to analyze the no action alternative as the current rule, right? Does that mean the current rule that says end of fish, or is that with the Lenny minimal, which is fish plus, essentially? To me, it would be helpful to me to have both of them analyzed against any change. What's the current practice with the memo, and what's the current rule, which is basically the last fish?
Based on the conversation today, I'm not going to commit to how we're going to do that. This has been a very good conversation today. It's been very thought-provoking. But
well, it's just another note to put down when you get your cost benefit analysis.
Any other questions? I'm going really quick. Okay, so we included here the long-term application. So a little bit of discussion about this. There is the potential long-term applications are in rule. They exist only for small forest landowners. They're a 15-year application when approved, and it allows small landowners the opportunity to you know, strategically manage their their entire properties to capture markets and you know, gives them many options. In our rule, we need to do an analysis that looks at, with the change in the rule, should the board consider grandfathering in the approved long-term applications, or would each application need to be conditioned to reflect the new rule? And because this is about water typing, and I believe, staff will correct me if I'm wrong, it's in excess of 240 existing long-term applications that have water present within the application. So we need to start that analysis now, because part of our the board needs to have knowledge as to how this would affect LTAs. So the analysis, with the final completion analysis, will be at the time that we bring forward the final draft rule for the board consideration and adoption. But it's a very important piece of information, and it's information we need to gather now, and it's something that we can bring forward, kind of a preliminary results at the time that we that the board is considering the filing of the CR 102. So what's this mean? At the June 27th meeting, the board will consider the rule proposal, which will include the analysis of each set of board-approved potential PHB criteria options. Upon the board approval, a CR 102 is filed with the Office of the Code Revisor, and this then, as I said earlier, begins the formal rulemaking. So we will schedule rulemaking hearings, and as a result of the comments received during these hearings, we begin to prepare a preliminary, concise explanatory statement, which the board then will see all of the questions brought to us with the potential answers, and that's part of the board's consideration at the time that you're reviewing the final package for adoption. Again, as I said earlier, the long-term application analysis will be completed, and a rule implementation plan is completed, and that really means training. What will be the training be for DNR and all of our sister agencies, as well as for the public at large, in preparation for the implementation of the new rule? At the November meeting, that's the final rule proposal, draft CAES, the concise explanatory statement, final cost-benefit analysis and small business economic analysis, as well as the long-term application report, are considered by the board. With the rule adoption, staff will file CR 103, which is a rulemaking order. The concise explanatory statement is finalized and distributed to all of the commenters. So if you made a comment, you'll get a copy of the CES with our response. And then the rule becomes effective, the word I forgot earlier, 31 days after filing, or at a later date if the board chooses to establish it, the date certain when you want the rule to become effective. So to determine or to meet the November board meeting timeline, the following actions need to be taken tomorrow by the board. Decide on which set of potential PHB criteria options to include in the rule proposal, and then direct staff to begin to prepare the CR 102 rulemaking packet. You will not have to do a 102 tomorrow, but this is telling staff to begin to do all the assessments and develop the products that the board needs to have in order to file a CR 102. Any questions?
So I want to make sure I can summarize for the board what you just told us. So tomorrow, we'd like to try and make some decisions
around the metrics for PHBs, and then direct staff to move forward on some reports. One of the things that I thought was missing out of your presentation is there was nothing about developing technical guidance with stakeholders.
Good point.
So, I mean, nobody's going to want to adopt a rule without knowing what guidance might be used to actually implement that rule or suggested to implement that rule. So the idea is by, and we won't make any decisions today, obviously, anything, including the staff recommendations on timing and everything. But what staff is putting forward is that by the June date, we would have a preliminary SEPA threshold determination. We would have draft rule language with whatever options we choose on. We would have a draft SBEIS. We would have a draft CBA. What am I leaving out? There's five things.
LTA stuff.
And then the current status of LTA, which is long-term map, and it's just kind of a general.
And then that will hopefully, you know, what I've been hearing a lot of is people wanting more information to make better decisions when we go to rulemaking, which in essence is when we go to the CR1-2. So you would have all that information and be able to decide whether to carry forward with all the options you choose next week. You could potentially eliminate options if you so choose, I believe. And then between the CR102 and the 103 is the public process. You know, so you put it out on the street, take public, we have public hearings on the proposal. And also public comment on the SEPA checklist or whatever preliminary determination you make on SEPA. And then you'd have the information you need to make a final decision. And then
is the reason that we would go to rule, final rule adoption in November instead of August is that if we're going to look at this whole packet and approve the 102 on June 27th, we wouldn't have enough time. We wouldn't have enough time between June 27th and August board meeting to do the whole public process.
Right. So the CR102 is and I believe it's only two dates a month in which you can submit requests to be published in the state register. So this has formalized the extent that the board's intended initiation of formal rulemaking that has to be in the state register. Then there's a time frame after the publishing in which you hold public hearings, and then staff needs time to do the CBS. So if we to give us a little extra time to perform all the analysis, we've shortened the time between the special meeting and the August meeting, and that's not enough time in order to accomplish the public hearings. So by necessity, it would push the rule adoption to the November meeting.
So would it matter, I mean, hypothetically, if there was only one, one rulemaking option to compare to the sort of status quo or no action alternative, would you still need that amount of time, or is it because so the fact that there's the possibility of considering more than one option in addition to the no action alternative, that doesn't change this timeline?
Oh, you mean in preparation for the 102?
Right.
So let me So in talking with staff, it became clear that in order to make May
And we don't expect that to happen. And so, the other advantage of moving out to June is one of the things that staff, along with stakeholders, could do. They could, so once they draft the rule and they draft the draft guidance, they could actually pull out and have time to try it out in the woods. And I think that would be valuable information for you as well.
Yeah. So the presentation, by the way, this was entirely focused on the rule, what you need for the rule, but the chair is correct. By practice, when you need guidance in order to implement the rule, we do share the guidance, and so we will be. And again, Mark has also put a call out for stakeholder participation in the development of guidance. The new board members, Section 23. So that would be available to the board and will be shared at the same time that we share all the other information, so that when people are reviewing the rule, they'll also be able to see the associated guidance, and that will help them understand as to whether, you know, how easy the rule could be implemented.
Any other questions from board members? Everybody ready for a break?
Did you say it now?
Thank you, Mark. Let's take 15. Let's start back at 5 till 3.
Bring some of that.